And I welcome you. Some of you are here for the first time, and or the second time, and some have been here countless times. I hope that everyone feels equally at home. It's a little surprising how long 40 minutes can feel if it's your first time. And, you know, the teaching about sitting practice is to just allow thoughts to come and go. And sometimes it's really not about thoughts at all. It's really about my leg is falling asleep very slowly, starting at the toes. How can I do this without disturbing the people next to me? You know, sometimes it's all about the body part of it. The relativity of time in Zazen, Einstein had something to say about that. When asked about relativity in a non-scientific way, he said something like this. If you spend a minute on a hot stove, it feels like an hour. If you spend an hour on a park bench with a pleasant person, it feels like a minute. The relativity of time carries in Zazen as well. I want to make sure that everyone knows we have a few empty seats tonight. I'll tell you where the other practice leaders are. Patrick is visiting a Dharma companion who practiced here for a long time in Northern Europe. And Kokyo is nearby. His mom passed away this morning, so he's with his feelings. It's a big transition for anybody in their life. Kathy is away tending to a Sangha member who is ill. And Dana is at Tassajara right now. So everyone knows that we are together, and sometimes we can't be all physically present at the same time. Please excuse their absence, and hopefully I can serve you well. Last week, Kathy talked about the mountains and rivers teaching, the sutra of mountains and rivers, and talked about the ways in which being with nature in a very intimate way, sometimes by drawing pictures, that's a way of opening the sense gates to see what we're actually seeing. She talked about being with great nature in this way, and that involved several hikes, both urban and out in the wild. And one of the conclusions, of course, is that nature is everywhere. We don't have to go far or far afield to find it. It's right here in our own patio. So the same is true with social justice causes. They might be grand, or they might be quite intimate right here in Sangha. Socially engaged Buddhism, which is, for me, a main focus of my practice, this combined with tending to the needs of the earth and our presence on the earth are actually part of one package. We often think of the social world and the natural world as distinct, but this is all one package, and I'd like to speak about how I find that to be true. Simply put, this practice is about the recognition that each of us, as an individual being, is a part of all beings, an integral part of all beings, and each thus has equal import. So this is true at the social level, and this is true in the natural world. And I'd like to speak about this very directly through two of our precepts. You know, we have, in some versions, five precepts. These are guidelines for ethical living. In some versions, 10, and we recite 16. So these precepts can be looked at individually, one at a time, in the admonitions part of it. A disciple of Buddha does not take life. A disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given, and so on. Or we can look at them in their positively stated phrase, a disciple of Buddha cultivates and encourages life. Or there is one, a disciple of Buddha does not misuse sexuality. In its positively phrased way, in my way, a disciple of Buddha is trustworthy in relationship. So this goes beyond sexuality. This is all of our relationships. So we can look at them all as a group. We can look at them individually. And they do actually coincide in pairs and triads. So I'll talk about a pair this evening. And in this context, it's important to note that the Buddha's last teaching, it's called the Parinirvana Sutra. In the Buddha's last teaching, just before dying, he was admonishing his monks and nuns, really, to say, don't worry, my physical presence is passing. And the precepts are exactly the same as my actual presence in the world. That's kind of the punchline of the Parinirvana Sutra. And it's not the recitation of the words, of course, that we're talking about. It is the activity of returning to the precepts that is itself, that activity is itself an expression of our own Buddha nature, having the wherewithal to realize that we have tipped off and we are returning. This is the expression of our own Buddha nature. In this way, the precepts are a very current and ongoing expression of Buddha's presence in the world. So the two that I'd like to pair this evening, maybe like pairing a good wine with a meal. Let's think of it that way. I'll pair these two. One is called, a disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of another. And the second one that I'll make reference to, a disciple of Buddha is not possessive of anything. Let me unwind them one at a time and see then if we can, as a group, put them together. Praising self, we can understand as elevating oneself or putting one's self first. Sometimes this is totally the most appropriate thing to do, and sometimes it's completely the most inappropriate thing to do. We have to balance. So in order to be able to balance, we become aware of the place that we hold. And for those who have been here for a couple of my most recent Dharma teachings, I've spoken about the four guardians that are present there on the bowing mat and are present on our robes. Briefly, north, south, east, west, the multiple faith traditions around the world have this marker of north, south, east, west. This is not unique to Buddhism. So, in this particular way of thinking of it, north is represented by rain, therefore it's water, therefore it's fluid. Mm-hmm. South is represented by wind, and kind of counterintuitively, this means stability. The counterintuitive part of this is those who understand the life of forest trees tell me that strong winds cause the tree's roots to grow deeply. Therefore, wind and stability go together. So we have fluidity and stability in counterposition. Then east and west. East represents harmony, and the west represents perspective. And the west is represented by the type of dragon that flies horizontally and gets wide view. So perspective. We walk in balance. We do our lives in balance. Somewhere between fluid and stable, both are true, and somewhere between knowing when it is right to step back and get perspective or when it is right to move in and offer harmony. This is the kind of perspective I'm talking about. So we have to be aware of the sometimes privileged place that we hold. This past week, I've been doing some pretty heavy garden work, and I was working with a friend. We together moved 9 yards of dirt twice. So I don't know if you have the understanding. 1 yard of dirt measures 3 by 3 by 3 feet. That's a lot of dirt, times 9, twice. So as we were working, we were entertaining each other with songs and talking. And also during this week, Kathy lost her wallet and her phone. So in the midst of losing wallet and phone, I was talking with my friend as we were moving dirt, and he was sharing a story. And that is, in the past, when he has seen lost wallets, he has learned the hard way to not pick them up, because he's been accused of taking that wallet. So I asked him, well, what do you do now if you see a lost wallet or a dropped phone? And he says, made me cry, I ask a white guy to pick it up because I know the cops won't bother him. That moment taught me something about privilege, what he lives with on an ongoing basis. So, not only aware of our position in four directions, but aware of our position in society. The simplest act in which we might have privilege. So, awareness of our body placement, not putting ourselves above another, or insisting that we take up more space than another, equal space, you know? Basically, it is an awareness that we're not alone, that we collectively occupy this space each with equal value. So this translates when we chant together, for example, I'm encouraging you to keep your eyes open. Stay connected to this group of people. Therefore, you also keep your ears open. Are our voices in harmony? Are we doing this thing together? You know? Harmony is one of my particular quirks. My ears seem to need it. So, not praising self means not elevating oneself or not necessarily putting one's own needs first. Although, sometimes it's appropriate to say, I have this need, can you support me? That's appropriate when the other person is agreeing to be there with you. Yep. Not praising self means having the perceptual field be broad and inclusive. This parallels, then, the Buddhist teaching, really, that our own individual place thoroughly and completely relies upon the place of another, or actually it's better to say, our own individual place thoroughly and completely relies upon every other being in their place. And this might be a stretch of the imagination, but I also will add, throughout space and time. A dear and wise friend has said recently while discussing this topic, praising self is always at the expense of another. perhaps that recitation, when we do the precepts, should just say, a disciple of Buddha does not praise self. I think Catherine may have added, at the expense of another, when discussing, you know, where is the place where one can feel satisfied with one's own work? Step back from that newly planted garden and say, that looks pretty good. Or we did a good job. That's not the kind of praising self I'm talking about, you know? This is the praising self that is elevating oneself as if more valuable than another. So, this, now paired with, is not possessive of anything. The usual way of understanding this is about generosity. You know, it's not possessive. No, a disciple of Buddha is not possessive of dharma or wealth. That is, we share our resources freely when we can. We share our knowledge and understanding freely. When we are confident of what we know, we want to share what we know, and we do that freely. It's natural. When someone asks about a Zendo form, do I bow this way or that way first? It's fine. Share what you know. So, not being possessive means just freely giving of oneself, not necessarily at the expense of oneself. You know, there's that balance that I've hinted at. It doesn't mean overextending one's self. The new twist on a disciple of Buddha is not possessive of anything that I would like to add this evening is this, that it also includes not being possessive of our own fixed views, like not holding to this view as the only possible way of thinking about something. We are about to enter a new, probably fairly wild political cycle. And this is where we are tested deeply in not holding to fixed views. Here's what I know about that. I have to catch myself thinking sometimes, what's wrong with these people? Does anybody else have that thought? Yeah. How could they be getting it so wrong? You know, that's an expression of me holding a fixed view. People have their positions, their opinions, based on the conditions of their life. My view is only my view, and each one of us, irreplaceable, irreplicable, and inexplicable. Like if I tried to explain all of the conditions that influence my point of view, I would bore you to pieces. Don't need to do that, other than to know that each one of us has this unique point of view, and this is true for everyone, even for those who hold a point of view that is opposite to our own and seemingly wrong. So, in this way of not being possessive of anything, I'm inviting us into a style of engaging with people who have different opinions that is a style of inquiry. Please tell me what informs your opinion. I'd like to know about that. It's the personal connection that will matter. We get curious at a social level rather than, I need to convince you that this view that I possess is right. So I'm not possessive even of this thing that I hold true, politically, environmentally, socially, however it is. I'd like to bring forward a book that has been recently recommended to me called Ecodharma, published in 2018. The author's last name is Loy, L-O-Y, Loy. Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. And David Loy makes reference fairly frequently to Joanna Macy and the other visionaries who began both analyzing and inquiring into what is the relationship between Buddhist thought and the need to pay attention to socially engaged Buddhism and environmental stewardship. So this particular piece, Loy is relating a story from his own teacher. And he writes it this way. One of my favorite Zen koans speaks to this. A student asks the master, "What is the constant activity of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas?" And David Loy's paraphrase of that is, "What is special about how enlightened people live moment by moment?" Perhaps the student was wondering if they manifest some extraordinary powers. The master's reply is short and simple. So the question, what is the constant activity of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? Responding appropriately. That's all. So the appropriately is kind of a big open book. Not elevating the self and not holding a fixed view requires that we know our position and that we know our intention. This is the work of practice. This is the work of what's happening during Zazen. I know that I have a particular set of conditions, my own personal set of dukkha. We call that suffering. My own personal set of out-of-balanceness. I bet you have yours. And we also have a collective or a systemic set of dukkha. So my personal suffering requires my personal response, and our collective dukkha requires a collective response. This is the theory behind what Joanna Macy has been speaking for decades now, and now David Loy in this book. One of the ways I have thought about it, and I was encouraged to find David Loy thinking about it this way, is that we spend Zazen kind of deconstructing our personal habits or our personal view, you know, or at least learning how to allow the thoughts coming and going without grabbing hold of them and running for the whole 40 minutes on a particular thought. We learn how to do that. So we learn how to deconstruct the habitual patterns of both body and mind as if they're separate. And it's kind of a waste of time. Oh, words get in the way for me. That's a little extreme to say waste of time, but I'm going to go with it here. It's kind of a waste of time if we simply reconstruct the same construct as soon as we walk out the door. We've spent this 40 minutes kind of becoming intimate with a habitual pattern, knowing it, and then we return to the habitual world that has all of the same stimulus that we would expect, and we re-engage those same habits. And this pattern goes on for years until at some point we go, I've played this song before. Maybe I'm looking for a slightly different ending to this particular piece of music, you know? So reflecting upon this human tendency to recreate the habitual, we're required in practice to kind of begin to see the long-term and ripple-out effects of our actions. This is, in simplest terms, what people know as karma. And related to Kathy's wallet issue, somebody found her wallet and called me because I was listed on, as her, what do we call it, emergency contact. So they called me and, do you know this person and would you like to come and get her wallet and phone? So I did, of course, and thanked them and asked, well, would you all like a reward? Everything was intact. Money was in there, cards were in there, phone was fine, everything fine. Would you all like a reward? And this person goes, no, that's just good karma. Sweet. You know. We understand this intuitively. You know, it's in our everyday vernacular to say good karma. I don't know if he probably did. I don't know if he did actually know exactly what he was saying. But yeah, good karma. You know, the long-term ripple out of every action continues indefinitely. It's hard to believe that, and it's true. Not just my personal actions, but our collective actions back into history. From which each one of us benefits and probably each one of us also suffers in some way. So our practice is to recognize the conditions, and this is the actual literal meaning of karma, to recognize the actual conditions and then within that set of conditions choose an action. That volitional action is the literal meaning of karma. It has not much to do with what comes back as good karma. It's just enacting karma, the cycle of cause and effect. So the scale of what is needed, both socially and environmentally, is so immense that I catch myself doing this. You know, I can't hold the whole scale. I would imagine that some of you do this as well. So at least I'm going to recycle and reuse this plastic bag. This much I have control over. And I don't have control over the whole works. And yet, the systemic is where we need to do our collective work. How do we do that? You might be looking at me for an answer. I can't give you that answer. But collectively we know. We look at it like, you know, the problem is not recycling. The underlying problem is the overconsumption of resources. So when we can begin to address the underlying problems, we can do something with it, actually. Here's what we have in our teaching related to this. On a daily basis in most temples around the world, the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra is recited or chanted. And in there, there's a line that says, form is emptiness, and that's followed immediately by emptiness is form. Let me talk for a moment about emptiness. The original word for this in before it was translated as emptiness is shunyata. And contemporary teachers are translating this now as boundlessness. Little different feeling than emptiness. And that boundlessness is that each and every speck of the universe has within it the whole boundless works. Therefore, it's empty of itself. It's empty of self-existence. It's one way of thinking of it. So form is emptiness. That's relatively easy to get a handle on. And the second part of that equation is rarely referred to. That emptiness is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. Those are what we call the five skandhas. So that's an abbreviated way of saying emptiness is form Emptiness is feelings, emptiness is formations, emptiness is perception, emptiness is consciousness. Emptiness or boundlessness shows up as the individual in form. Boundlessness shows up as feelings. Boundlessness shows up as perceptions, formations, consciousness, and so on. So, here's how I see it. We honor this teaching of emptiness or boundlessness by working to create the place, create the way where expression is harmonious. Because this is actually in accord with the way things are. When we intervene our own way, that is, being possessive of something or praising ourselves, we're interrupting the natural flow of things. But even that is wrong to say. Words are really problematic, you know, because the interrupting is part of the flow. There's nothing separate from the flow. Sorry, I can't. Words are just problematic all the way around. I'm returning to somebody else's words for a while. This is back to David Loy. Awakening to the unborn, that's another way of saying awakening to emptiness, awakening to boundlessness. Awakening to emptiness is incomplete because deconstruction of the constructed sense of self does not automatically transform how we relate to people. Right? Even if we have a deep and intuitive understanding of emptiness or boundlessness, we still have to put that in place in our behavior. David Loy goes on. Our deep-rooted and usually self-preoccupied habitual ways of thinking, feeling, and acting tend to have a life of their own, which means that a gradual reconstruction of how we actually live in the world is also necessary. And then David gives us a kind of a formula. We have what in our practice are called the three poisons, greed, ill will, and delusion. The formula then is to transmute these, and that word transmute I don't take lightly, in the same way that alchemists used to turn dross or waste into gold. We transmute these three poisons into generosity, loving kindness, and the wisdom that recognizes that my well-being is not separate from your well-being or that from the earth itself. Mm-hmm. And then parenthetically, loving kindness, you know, if you can't quite get all the way to loving kindness, he's got, or at least basic friendliness. So, generosity, basic friendliness, and wisdom that recognizes our interconnection. This recognition that our well-being is tied up with each other and the well-being of the whole is where I say eco-dharma lives. And this is where social engagement lives as well. So, let's have some conversation about how do we actually enact that. You know, we might be devoted to this or inspired by that or encouraged by something else, and that's uplifting. But then how do we spend that energy? How do we even choose where to spend that energy? You know, our favorite cause? Well, maybe. And can that view even be broadened? There's no one and nothing who can make this choice for you about where to spend that inspiration. So, where does your activity of returning to the precepts show up in your day-to-day life? If basic friendliness is what you can muster, I'm good with that, you know. And if what you can manage is the grand scale of solving the environmental crisis, let's go with that one too. How do you do it? Or, at least, what do you wish it looked like? Let's start there. What do you wish your own activity looked like? Yes, Richard. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Showing up, and you know, there is this bit about following the gut that has to be paired with reason. Like, where exactly is my gut telling me to go, and where exactly will my activity have the most influence? So, with whom to join and where to join is also a question that's answered by reason.
Also listening for the call.
Yes.
Where did the call come from?
There's another recent book that I don't have in front of me. The title is The More Beautiful World. I think this is The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. It's definitely worth reading because it works with these layers upon layers of where is our individual action most appropriate? Our hearts know this is possible. Our hearts know what's right. And then we find a place and a response. We're all in somewhere. Yeah, thank you, Richard. Mary.
You asked about where it shows up for each of us in practice, and I think the place where I see it show up in practice for me is in my interactions with people at work or family or friends, and I think one of the examples that you've given before, which always resonates with me, is somebody says something to me or I perceive what they're doing with a visceral reaction where, you know, I get attention, then I know that I have to pause, because if I don't, my action won't be, my action or speech won't be kind, useful, or true. So that, for me, that's probably one of the real keys is if I feel that tension from an interaction, I have to pause before I can say something, or what I'm going to say is going to come from the reptilian part of my brain and not from my heart. And I think the other thing that I notice is sometimes just even going to the grocery store and being kind to the person in front of you or in the back of you or talking to the person that is helping you. It's interesting how something as simple as that sometimes can bring either yourself joy or the person that you're interacting with joy.
Yeah.
Just that simple acknowledgement of somebody else. But I really am struggling with what you said about what's going on in our country today. and not speaking up about it or having an opinion about it. Mm. You know, if I think about children that are interned, I don't see how it cannot be wrong, and I think that staying silent allows it to continue. So,
yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Thank you. The first part first, that sense of tension or constriction teaches you something. And I would say your activity that you have learned to pause before letting the reptilian brain respond is itself an example of not praising self, not elevating yourself, and is itself an example of not being possessive. That little pause, even if it's a microsecond, is enough to open the heart to allow something else to be reconstructed. There. That's exactly right on. So please understand that I'm not advocating for silence. I'm not advocating that you not have an opinion. It's required that we act in accord with our values. What I'm asking for is that when we choose where to take action, we do this with the purest intent. Mm-hmm. That is, what about those children? I care about them. My action is connected to the children rather than to the politics that drove this. Yeah? So it's not about holding silence and not about not having an opinion. It's choosing when and how with the not possessive and not elevated self. Mm-hmm. It's a tricky line to walk. And there's no formula. If there were a formula, I would give it to you. Yes,
yeah,
Yara.
It does seem like that the line between fixed views and views kind of based on an ethical wish or belief, that just seems like a very tricky.
Yes. I'll tell you honestly, one of the things that has mitigated my thinking about this is in other places where I teach, I have military and former military people in the community. It would be incorrect for me to hold a rigid position insisting, for example, that everyone be politically liberal or progressive. Because what I'm about is opening the Dharma to all. So I've learned how to soften this and not put my own political perspective first. Each person makes their way with this, including those whose activity and opinions we disagree with, even extremely disagree with. There are a set of conditions that brought that person to that place. I want to know about them. Mm-hmm. How can our points of view inform each other? I think it takes, in my own experience, it takes a lot more courage to not praise self, and it takes a lot more courage to not be possessive, to walk in this world with, no, I really don't know. I've kind of got a vague idea. And I know what feels right, but I really don't know. From curiosity, it's harder to live this way. I'm feeling warm. I'm in many layers. I'm looking for a little bit of refreshment out on the porch. Is it time for us to close for now? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are